This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.
Welcome to Return to the Pine Trees, a selection of six short stories for radio broadcast about growing up in the North Dublin areas of Turnipin Lane, Clunshock, Old Coolock Lane, Clochran and the village of Santry. These stories take place between 1965 and 1970 and they bring to life a time in these respective areas on the outskirts of Dublin City before it all changed forever. These areas weren't on their own when the changes came. There were many other small townlands and villages all around Dublin, both north and south, overwhelmed by a quickly expanding city. Unfortunately for my particular area, Turnipin Lane, which is just past Santry heading north towards Dublin Airport, change came from all sides. The city to the south, Dublin Airport to the north, and the M50 and M1 to the east. The airport in particular, which is only a mile away from Turnipin Lane, was a huge influence on the way things would go. I bring these stories to you, the listeners of Near FM Radio, hoping they are enjoyable to listen to and also to provide you a social record of what was happening on the outskirts of North Dublin in the late 1960s and the early 1970s. Some events have been combined to create a good narrative. In some cases, I go into a lot of detail, especially on my journeys from place to place and the people I meet along the way. This is the social document side of things. Music is very important to the stories, and in particular, Gilbert O'Sullivan, our Irish-born singer and songwriter. His songs always resonated a certain innocence, which is exactly what I want to convey in my stories. I hope they will act as triggers and transport you right into the very heart of the stories. Please join me on my journeys, and I hope you will enjoy the stories for what they are, stories about youth and growing up in North Dublin. I've decided to use my own voice and added some gentle sound effects as part of this radio book project, which gives the stories a little bit of depth, especially in the narrative. The name of this story is going to work for PJ Jones. It is the final story in our series of six. Going to work in Jones's farm was very much a rite of passage for all us young lads of Turnipin Lane. It was usually during the secondary school summer holidays, but sometimes there was some evening winter work available, especially coming up to Christmas, when there was a huge demand for parsnips and Brussels sprouts. A few Turnipin Lane men like Ned Farrell and his brother Johnny were employed full-time by PJ Jones. Johnny was a tall, skinny man, just like a potato stalk, so we called him Stalky. He wore a soft cloth cap, and Ned, his brother, was called the Duke because he looked like PJ Duke, the famous Cavan Gaelic footballer. Both of these men were the classic Irish bachelors who only lived 3 miles from the GPO but looked and sounded like they came from the heart of the west of Ireland. Indeed, their roots were in Strokestown, County Roscommon, where their father came from. They lived in number 19, just 2 doors from me. There were two other local lads, Jerry Heaney and Jerry Madden, who were also employed full-time on Jones's farm. This group of full-time workers drove the tractors that pulled the trailers, the cabbage planting machines, the ploughs, the potato harvesters, and all the other mechanical gizmos that were required to keep a tillage farm ticking over. In early springtime, All of these would be engaged in getting the soil ready for the planting that would take place throughout the spring and summer. Once the summer came and the ground was bursting with the first crop of vegetables, the cannon fodder labour was called in, and that was us. 13 or 14 was the usual starting age in Jones's, and the ritual for asking for a start was around June, just as secondary school holidays were looming. My first season was in the summer of 1970, and I did four seasons there in all, up to the summer of 1973, the year I finished my intermediate certificate in Belcam College. I was technically finished primary school when I started, so I did what everybody did, I lied about my age. PJ needed a few lads to do a bit of weeding in the drills, so Johnny Fardell left word that he wanted us to drop down to see him. The talking was something you had to do personally. No around the houses on this one. You had to go down, knock on the door, talk to Mr. Jones himself directly. I suppose this was my very first job interview. If you'd been there the previous summer and didn't behave yourself, you would get a reminder from PJ and you may not be taken back. To be honest, very few were ever not taken back. My memory of my first interview was interrupting Mr. Jones during his lunch and waiting nervously as his wife Teresa answered the back door. It was all a bit noisy back then in the Joneses' household, with the young Jones children, Kenneth, David and Barbara, running around the place. Baby Joseph would arrive later. When PJ eventually appeared, he seemed a little miffed that I had interrupted his lunch. Not a good start, I thought. He was very officious with me as he wiped away his lunch from his mouth. He asked me my age, my name. I remember saying something about pulling bulky shanks or ragwort weeds for Willie Snow and Stephen Fowler the previous summer, to give him the impression I had loads of experience in the weed pulling game. Knowing Johnny Farrell, who lived beside me in Turnipin, helped. And the fact that my grand-aunt Sissy Fitzsimons lived down the road from Mr. Jones did me no harm either, as I stuttered my way through my introductions. My brother Noel was with me, and Johnny Darcy was there as well. Derek Madden had already started a week earlier, with Jerry, his older brother, getting him his start. Mr. Jones said yes, and we were all to start the following Monday, 8 o'clock, bright and early. I was thrilled. On our very first day, we all walked together from Turnipin to Jones's farm. Noel Murphy joined the crew as we headed down our garden, out through Heaney's Gap, past the sewerage pumping station, then out onto the back road, where we passed Curtin's on the left, and down on to the corner at Madden's, giving Derek a shout as we passed. On this, our very first morning trek, the whole journey took at least 20 minutes. As we crossed four or five fields, ending up in Jones's big yard shed. All of the Turnipin lads were great workers, and the full crew, as I remember it, was myself, Noel Cooley, Johnny Darcy, Noel Hacker Murphy, Derek Madden, Jerry Heaney, Jerry Madden, Tommy Kavanagh, Oliver Bourke, Johnny Fardell, and of course the man himself, PJ Jones. PJ was very much the hands-on type, and every morning he was there, giving us our orders, explaining what needed to be done, and then we headed off to the various fields. He wasn't a very tall man, and he wore a cap most of the time. In general, he was good-natured and friendly. He treated us fairly and with respect, and every day he himself worked very hard on the farm. Weeding was our very first job, and the fields containing the drills with the early cabbage and the cauliflowers were ours. This had to be done by hand, as PJ did not like using chemicals to control the weeds once the plants were in the ground. The cabbage drills were first, and PJ gathered up a half a dozen crew and started us on 6 drills at a time. He always gave us a demonstration of how he wanted things done. He would stay with us for an hour or so, making sure that we weren't pulling up the cabbage plants along with the weeds. Once we finished one drill, we came to the headland and then just turned and started a new drill in the opposite direction. Some drills had more weeds than others, so there was an incentive to finish yours first, as you got first pick of the next 6. If someone was falling behind, PJ would jump in on the drill, bringing them level with the others. This was back-breaking work, and you knelt to one side of the drill in the furrow as you moved along, throwing the pulled weeds behind you. When PJ wasn't around, the messing would start, and we would be flinging the weeds back into the face of our nearest comrade. Anything to relieve the boredom. Johnny Farrell was sometimes left to weed with us, a sort of prefect or supervisor, if you like. He had a really dry sense of humour, and when we were messing, he would stand up and slowly say, while pretending to be talking to Mr. Jones, "PJ, the lads are all messing and lying down in the drills and they won't do any work at all. And PJ, Jerry Heaney got sick and vomit off them and everything." These words were delivered in a very slow, deadpan voice, with half a smile on his face. He always made me laugh with this one. Lunchtime came at 1 o'clock, and for this we got a full hour. In the absence of watches, we relied on the church bells in Lark Hill to give us a noontime break. Us Turnipin lads galloped home for lunch through the fields, and poached eggs on toast with beans was the usual fare. I loved when Ma had it waiting for us, but sometimes we had to cook it ourselves, because she was off shopping in town. In Dublin, in other words. Jesus, we left the kitchen in some state. Everything would be flung into the basin, and once we sprinkled Daz detergent on top of the greasy plates. Ma later explained that Quicks was what we should be using to wash the dishes, not the clothes detergent, but at least you tried, she added. The opening music to the RTE radio show, Dear Frankie, always transports me back to those hurried lunch hours. Wow, 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 droned the lazy trumpet, and the problems on this lunchtime show really captivated the nation. "Well, I'm not sure who the real culprit is here," Frankie Bourne would say in her deep smoker's voice. "But waiting on a proposal of marriage for 35 years seems a little bit of a long wait to me. So Mary in County Mayo, what you really need to do, ask this fella of yours out straight what his intentions are, good, bad or indifferent." Ma would interject if she was listening, "Mary, get effing rid of him now and get yourself a Jesus life, Mary," she would shout at the radio. Ma never sat down to listen. She stood at the sink and listened happily as she washed and washed, peeled and peeled, cooked and cooked for us all. Ma loved getting stuck into the housework. The windows would be flung open and a load of washing going onto a high line on a warm, dry, windy day was very, very rewarding and uplifting for her. After our first week of back-breaking weeding, we got paid in the late Friday afternoon as we finished up and gathered in the big green shed. PJ came out of the kitchen door, clasping a handful of white envelopes with our names, our hours and our totals, all written in biro, in hand, on the front. My first wages in the summer of 1970 was 15 shillings. We were rich. By 1972, it had risen to the princely sum of £2.50. We had joined the EEC and had gone decimal. The split was £2 for Ma, with me and Noel getting to keep the 50 pence. This 50p was worth the old 10 shillings. As an extra treat on pay night, Ma would bring me and Noel home a can of Coke and a full packet of McVitie's Home Wheat chocolate biscuits each from the supermarket in Northside. These we duly scoffed all in one sitting. We only shared the last of the biscuits with the brothers and sisters when we couldn't eat any more ourselves. After weeding the drills of cabbage, next up came the drills of spuds. These were only done once, because when the spuds started growing, the weeds among them had no chance. Pretty soon, the first cabbages were ready for cutting for market, and this was my favourite job. The morning of the first cabbage cutting, PJ arrived into the big shed and started stacking up old, empty 10-10-20 net nitrogen bags. We stood a little bemused, but Jerry Heaney and Johnny Farrell started doing the same because they knew what they were required for. Summer nights brought heavy dews, so the cabbage leaves would hold the water, and they would always be wet, hence the old nitrate bags to keep your legs dry. PJ gathered us up in a circle and went into demonstration mode again. Pre-cutting four separate lengths of twine, he proceeded to roll one bag around his leg and tied him in place with two pieces of twine on each, one at crotch height and the other just under the knee. We thought he looked hilarious, and we giggled and tittered as he strutted round like a cowboy who had just lost his horse. Tommy the Egg Kavanagh was pulling faces, so was Jerry Heaney, just to get us younger lads going. PJ was not amused, and the crosser he got, the more we laughed. Our laughter, however, was going to be short-lived. Moore's truck would be arriving at lunchtime to collect 250 dozen cabbages, which equated to 3,000 heads. We didn't have to travel too far, because the front road field beside the grass tennis court was our destination. Johnny Farrell drove ahead in the Massey Ferguson 165, pulling a trailer of empty steel wire crates. Jerry Heaney was out on the back throwing them off at various intervals. He had this ritual when he was enjoying himself.
Ha ha, hurry hurry,
he would shout, grabbing himself in the crotch with one hand, his other on his hat, as he bobbed from side to side, one tiptoe to the other. We had no idea what it meant, but it was hilarious to see and hear. Jerry was big and strong, and he needed to be, as these crates held 2 dozen cabbages. The lighter lads were given the job of cutting the cabbages and piling them onto the centre furrow as we moved forward about 6 drills at a time. When the cutting started, there was another demonstration from PJ. First, he explained, we won't be cutting every head out of the drill, only the ones that are big enough. Using his hand, he placed it over the head to show us the size he wanted. Next, he said, when swinging the blade, keep your eyes open for someone too close to you getting in your way. If you're not sure, don't swing the knife. It's very sharp, and it could cut someone's arm off. Lastly, he said, and just then, he did a bit of a high-pitched throat clearance, which caught us all by surprise, and again the sniggering started. Johnny Darcy was the absolute worst for doing this. Anything started him off imitating and sniggering. One of his most famous Jews sayings when anything funny was going on was nip-nip muttered under his breath. I did my best to control the laughter, but my face was roaring red as I coughed my way out of it. Lastly, he repeated slowly and demonstrated as he spoke, when cutting the head from the stalk, still rooted in the ground, don't cut too low into the soil or you'll break your wrist. If you cut too high, I will lose cabbage leaves and you might lose your fingers. Now stop behaving like schoolgirls and get to work. PJ Jones never used bad language. As we cut through the cabbages, they were crated carefully, ensuring the butt faced outwards and so protecting the head which faced inwards. Once a crate was filled with 24 cabbages, it was left behind for Johnny Farrell and Jerry Heaney, who had looped back behind us in the tractor and trailer. The bigger lads, Tommy Kavanagh and Jerry Madden, threw up the full crates while Jerry Heaney stacked them. I loved this work, and I felt like a jungle traveller hacking my way through the dense undergrowth. I was very good, never missing a swing with a sharp-bladed knife. As I mentioned, this front road field was close to the grass tennis court. During the hot summer months, Mrs. Jones and her friends would sometimes play tennis there while we were working close by. These older women bouncing around in tennis shorts and tops were a welcome sight for us testosterone-charged youth, our very first glimpses of eye candy, so to speak. When we started cutting cauliflowers, it was the same story, only we had to be very careful not to damage the head itself. Cutting cauliflower involved an extra piece, and again, this was demonstrated by PJ. When the head was cut at the base, the leaves then had to be trimmed while you held the head in your hand. The trick was to leave enough leaves around the head to give it protection in the crate. One time, somebody decided to use the knife blade to pull back the leaves to inspect the size of the head. Unfortunately, the head was being nicked by the tip of the knife blade, and when PJ spotted this one with a complete line of destroyed cauliflowers, he blew a fuse. He gathered us all in around, and yes, there was another demonstration. When the cutting of the cabbages and the cauliflower started, there was a small perk, as you got to bring a few home for the house. On my first Friday to bring some cabbages home, I came in by bicycle. I loaded the plastic bag full of cabbages, balancing the bag on the crossbar as I went. I left Jones's by the front gate and I turned right for home. The first house I passed was old Mrs. McGurk's small red cottage. She was a widow and a very old woman who wore a dark navy old-fashioned pinny. PJ had given me some cabbage to drop into her. This was the first of many visits I would make to see Mrs. McGurk. One day as we got talking, she ended up playing me some of her Doris Day records. She knew my grandfather Bill Cooley well because she bought coal from him. On down the road from Mrs. McGurk's cottage, I met old Ned Fowler, chewing his pipe and sitting beside the milk churns outside the gate of his small dairy farm, which was on the left-hand side. Things were really quiet back then, and he would be looking for a bit of company. I always said hello. Ned's youngest son, Stephen, or Skitcher as we call him, was a great character, and you could often hear him singing back in the milking shed at the top of his voice. Now here's a song that hit the top. It's Elvis Presley and I'm All Shook Up.
Well, bless my soul, but what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm out.
Now dig this man from Tennessee. It's Jim Reeves, but it's really me.
I'm all shook up.
Stephen Fowler, in my mind, represented what people from places like Turnipin and Clonshock were all about back then. Hard workers, but always up for a bit of fun. Just past Fowler's, staying on the left, there was Gunning's farm, and they mostly grew flowers. My two childhood pals, Christy and Jared, lived there with their two sisters, Gloria and Shirley. Next was Andrew's modern bungalow on the right, then on down the road only to meet the first big obstacle, which was Jolly's Hill. This was a really big hill and I had to dismount because it was that steep. Once up the hill, I headed on up the road, passing the yard entrance into Colonel McKenna's big house on the left. Next was the semi-detached house that the lady golfer Mary McKenna lived in. She was the Colonel's niece. And next door to Mary lived the Gannons, who I think were related to her as well. On again for a few hundred yards past McKenna's and Gannons, I travelled around Tinker's Corner, and then on by Madden's and McGurk's. By the time I got to Heaney's Gap, I was well and truly knackered. The gap itself was narrow, and it was near impossible to get through on a bicycle with a bag of vegetables in tow. It was best to drop the bag to the ground, drag it through on your own, and then follow along with the bicycle. The gap ran along the outer wire fence of the sewerage pump station, and as I manoeuvred the bicycle, my knuckles took a bashing. Oh yes, just what I needed at the end of a hard day's work, but it was worth it. Ma was always delighted to see the carry out of vegetables from Jones's farm. Back on Jones's farm, it will come as no surprise to anyone that I started to get a bit of flack from PJ over talking too much. He once remarked that if I could work as hard as I could talk, he could let all the other lads go home. Hands up, yes, I was a bit chatty. After mastering weeding and cutting cabbages with the sharp knives, the next big event for me was learning to drive. My big chance came when the potatoes were ripe for harvesting. PJ was a very progressive farmer, and the labour-intensive way of hand-picking the spuds was old hat. He duly bought this big massive machine that lifted up a complete drill as it went along, turned it over, spread and scattered the soil and the spuds up onto a rotating platform.
5, 4, 3.
The huge machine was bright red and it looked like something from the Thunderbirds television series.
Thunderbirds are go.
It had big spinning wheels and gadgets galore on board. This machine was the cat's pajamas and was very much the cradle to the grave potato picking solution. All it was short of having on board was canteen and toilets. When it came time to get this machine into service, it was always a big event. It was stored in the big road shed beside the house which opened out onto the public road. Since it required a tractor to pull it out of the shed, it had to be done quickly, because general road traffic would be held up. With it being out of service since the previous year, there was a fair bit of preparation involved to get all the parts checked and oiled for the new season ahead. A lot of this work was carried out before it left the shed, and this work was always very closely supervised by PJ himself. It had a platform for standing on, and was manned by at least 6 people who picked the spuds, dropping them into a channel that directed them around into a bag. When the bag was filled up to 4 stone weight, Johnny tied it off and just dropped it onto the ground to be picked up later by tractor and trailer. There was a little gizmo gun that twisted the wire to seal the 4 stone potato bags, and God help us if that went missing. Everybody was obsessed about it, especially PJ himself. Where's the bag tie? Who had the bag tie? Who had it last? And Jesus, God help you if you were named as the last person I saw with that was. No amount of explaining would suffice. You would just have to find it and present it to Johnny Farrell, the main potato bag tie-up man. This massive machine was connected to the tractor by a tow bar, and it was powered by a power take-off at the rear. It also had some hydraulic hoses which were also connected to the tractor. Before the harvester went near the drill of potatoes, the tops of the plants had to be trimmed off. This was done with one of the many attachments that were hooked to the back of a tractor. It was called the trimmers. This particular time, Tommy Cavanaugh was trimming ahead of us in the Massey Ferguson 165. And when he was coming around the headland, not too far from us, he was grinning and waving, not watching where he was going. We looked again, but Tommy and the tractor trimmer had just disappeared. He was just gone. There 1 second, gone the next. He had gone down into a huge field ditch. We all called out to PJ, who was driving the Massey Ferguson 135, which was pulling the harvester. He stopped the tractor and leaped out to where Tommy had been seen last. We all followed on to catch up and found Tommy in the tractor, wedged in the ditch, tractor on its side, and him still grinning up at us. Thankfully, Tommy wasn't hurt. And before long, we pulled out the tractor, using the big, powerful, Czechoslovakian-built, the Zetter. Meanwhile, back in the harvester, my big chance to drive was coming. PJ restarted the 135 and then it happened. He jumped out, leaving it at crawling speed, and asked me to get in and steer it. I was thrilled. All I had to do was keep the wheel centred in the drill furrows. Things were going well until we got near to the end of the drill. With about 20 feet to go to the headland, I started to panic, and I started to lock the wheels into a right turn. Before long, we were bobbing up and down as I cut across the drills, everybody hanging on for dear life. PJ jumped from the harvester platform, was running towards me, shouting and waving. He jumped into the tractor cab, pushing me to one side. After it was stopped, I explained he hadn't showed me the end of the drill routine. He agreed it was his fault, and yes, guess what? There was another demonstration. After that, I was the official potato harvester driver for the summer of 1970. Being the driver, it had its benefits, but it also had its drawbacks. Firstly, you were isolated a bit with no fun to be had messing with the others. Secondly, when PJ wasn't about, incoming sniggers, which were small potatoes, thrown by your disgruntled comrades, were sore on the back, neck and head when they hit you. Of all the funny stories I could relate about working in the fields for PJ Jones, one story in particular sticks out in my mind. Out in the fields there were no toilets, so the many ditches around were our only outlet. It was generally only peeing, but one time, one of our group, let's call him Mr. X, decided he just had to go for a number two. Now the secret here was to slip away unnoticed and do what you had to do. With your trousers down around your ankles, way down in the ditch, you are very, very vulnerable. This day, Mr. X slipped away quietly, but just as his hat disappeared out of sight, he was spotted by Johnny Darcy. The alarm was duly raised and an ambush was on the cards. The probable location of Mr. X down in the ditch was ascertained, and after a 2-minute lull to give him time to settle down, what I can only describe as a scene from the bombing of Baghdad was unleashed. Balls of muck rained down from the heavens on the poor unfortunate. Amid a lot of shouting and cursing, he eventually climbed back up out of the ditch, much the worse for wear. He had a graze over his eye as he emerged bleeding and groggy. Just at that very moment, Mr. Jones appeared in the field. He was absolutely livid. He ran around. He lined us up. He read us the riot act. Horseplay would not be tolerated. Somebody could have lost an eye, he shouted. It was the last time we did that particular one. Postscript. It's now nearly 40 years since I worked for PJ Jones, and I'm happy to report he's still going strong today. Long may he continue. You've just been listening to myself, Jerry Cooley, narrating one of my short stories, Going to Work for PJ Jones. This is the final story in my series of six, and I hope you've enjoyed the series. Thank you.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.